The format of the talk, I'm going to do a little introduction with some of the things that the Socialist Standard said about the Bolshevik revolution at the time. Then we're going to hand over to the guest speaker, Simon Pirani. And then we're going to have, he's going to speak for about 40 minutes. And then we're going to have questions and answers and some discussion. And then we'll hopefully bring it to a close and have a summary. Also, to make you aware, the talk we are recording, so if you don't want to be recorded and you would like to make a contribution, feel free to make a contribution, but just mention it at the end.
Will the recording be available?
It will be made available on the website in due course. Right, the title of this talk is The Russian Revolution in Retreat. And the Socialist Standard, which is our party journal, has the fortune of having run uninterrupted and been published since 1904. So we're one of the few publications still in existence that was able to cover the events in Russia in 1917 at the time. And I have an excerpt from May 1917 issue of the Socialist Standard. And this is what was written about the Russian Revolution. This is an event of some importance in the development of human society cannot be denied, but its importance is far less than and lies mainly in an altogether different direction from that which the capitalist press of the whole capitalist world would have us believe. Far from heralding the dawn of freedom in Russia, it is simply the completion of the emancipation of the capitalist class in Russia, which started in the emancipation of the serfs some 70 years ago, in order that they might become factory slaves. The revolution's greatest importance from the working class viewpoint is that it brings the workers face to face with their final exploiters. And in January 1918, issue of the Standard, we said, whatever may be the final outcome, the Bolsheviks have at all events succeeded in doing what all the armies, all the diplomats, all the priests and primates, all the perfidious pacifists of all the groaning and bleeding world have failed to do. They have stopped the slaughter for the time being at all events on their front. How much more than this they were intended to do, the future may reveal. They may have higher aims, yet to be justified by success or condemned by failure. But it is an astounding achievement that these few men have been able to seize opportunity and make the thieves and murderers of the whole world stand aghast and shiver with apprehension. And at that point, I'd like to hand over to our guest speaker, Simon Pirani, who's author of Russian Revolution in Retreat, 1920-1924, and also a lecturer on the subject of Russia and the Soviet Union, 1861-2000, Revolution, Continuity and Change. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Daryl, and thank you for inviting me, and thank all of you for coming out on a sunny Sunday afternoon when the park may have been tempting. And I'm hoping that I certainly intend to stick to the 40 minutes, and hopefully then you will have questions and discussion. And what I'm going to do in the 40 minutes is go over some of the main points in my book, The Russian Revolution in Retreat. This is the first time I've spoken since it was published in Russian, which I'm very, very pleased about. That's a big achievement for me, just as big as it being published in the first place in English. I've got a few sort of points of introduction about why I wrote the book. Then I will talk about Moscow in 1920-24. That was the specific time and place that I focused on. I'll talk about how Communist Party members experienced the events of that time, and how workers outside the Communist Party, who were much more numerous, experienced those events, and say something about how social relations changed. So the talk is going to really focus on stuff that happened. I'm sure many of you have been to meetings where left-wing organizations of one type or another have offered interpretations about the Russian Revolution and its degeneration, And I'll offer some of those interpretations at the end, and perhaps we can deal with that further in the discussion. The starting point for me, so if I explain the reason why I took quite a few years to research and write this book, the starting point for me was that the Russian Revolution was a defining, perhaps the defining event of the 20th century. It was a turning point in the history of class struggle and movements of social liberation. And not only was it one of the best and biggest examples in history of an event in which millions of ordinary people took an active part in trying to change the world in which they lived, but it also put, for the first time, state power into the hands of a party that claimed both to act for the working class and to be participating in the spread of international socialism. Within quite a short space of time, 20 years, that regime had turned into a nightmarish dictatorship that was effectively suppressing working class action and slaughtering those who tried to develop it. I mean, almost everybody associated with the workers' movement, with social movements now, would agree that by the 1930s, that's what that regime had become. There is, however, little agreement on how that transformation took place, about the relationship between the revolution and Stalinism, the relationship between Bolshevism and Stalinism, and about the lessons of those events. And the idea of my research was to try to get a better understanding of how those, of how relationships changed, how the relationship between working-class people in particular, who were one of the two great forces alongside people in rural areas who participated in that revolution, who came into political activity in a way that they'd never done before in 1917, how the relationship between them and the party that claimed to represent them, the Bolsheviks, changed. That was the thing I tried to get more detail on. I chose in the research not to look at the discussions among what we might call professional politicians, Bolsheviks, Mensheviks, people, many of whose work has been translated into English and other languages, and probably anybody who's been involved with the workers' movement for a long time, as I have, has read a lot of that stuff. I tried to look at what happened among ordinary workers who joined the Bolshevik Party, ordinary workers who did not join the Bolshevik Party. I kept that geographical focus on Moscow just in order to be able to get a reasonable handle on events. And to say something about myself, I joined the Trotskyist organization when I was very young, and I stayed in it until the early 1990s. That was the same time at which I started traveling to Russia. I've always had a background as an activist, and although the book was written as a PhD, it's published by an academic publisher, but I come very much from an activist background, and that was my commitment. And in fact, I was very involved for many years with labor and social movements in Russia and other former Soviet countries, and hopefully before the end, there's a couple of defense campaigns relating to people imprisoned for their political activity in Russia and Kazakhstan. I'll just perhaps talk about that at the end when we finish talking about the 1920s. So that's the introduction. So now to talk about... So again, I'm not going to try and tell the whole story. We'd be here for weeks. I want to concentrate on the time and space that I looked at in the book, which is Moscow in a fixed period. But I'm looking around the room. I don't think for many people here this would be the first meeting you've been to about the Russian Revolution. You're I think familiar with its importance, and the and Daryl just read out the quotations. It was an event that shook the world and the workers' movement of its time. So my story really begins at the end of the Civil War. So as soon as the Bolsheviks take power, they find themselves fighting really a series of civil wars at once, one against the Social Revolutionaries, the big party that claimed to represent the peasants who had split during 1917, fighting the whites, who were the out-and-out counter-revolutionaries, also many groups of peasants who didn't like the food requisitioning policy that the Bolshevik government had proceeded with on coming to power, and hadn't liked the food requisitioning under the provisional government either, and who thought that the revolution meant seizing land, and that they would then decide what to do with the foodstuffs they grew. And so really from 1917 through to 1921, you've got this continuous series of civil wars going on. And the period I looked at was the time when, to all intents and purposes, those various enemies had been suppressed, the counter-revolutionaries had been completely defeated, the various peasant revolts had been fairly firmly put down by the Red Army, and in discussion both within and outside the Bolshevik Party in 1920, there's talk about the new world that we're now going to build. So that's the point at which I started my research in detail. And it's also a point, 1920, the year 1920, when the awful legacy of 7 years of war and revolution lays very heavy on Russia as a whole and Moscow as well. And during that time of war and revolution, one characteristic of all Russian cities is that they shrank. People who had come into the countryside, either themselves or at most with their parents, or perhaps very few who'd been born in the cities, made up the vast majority of the population of these cities. This was an urbanizing society. And people's instinct in times of hardship was simply to return to the countryside. So Moscow shrank by half. Its population shrank between 1917 and 1920 from 2 million to 1 million. And of that 1 million who were left, half were a working age. And important to remember with Moscow, it's a particularly white-collar city. And when we're talking about the workers of Moscow, many of them are white-collar workers, government employees, municipal employees, people working in offices. And it's become the capital of the country in 1918, so a fair load of bureaucrats in the various ministries have travelled down from the old capital, Petrograd. And so that's the city that we're talking about. There's an enormous legacy of hardship and destruction as a result, again, of war and civil war, and that's across the country. Hyperinflation, wages were worth nothing, workers were paid in kind, by and large, in industry. The urban population depended on rations, and the size of these rations was a major cause of tension between workers and the Bolshevik government in 1920. Housing stock was a mess. Firewood was short. You can read loads of newspaper articles about people chopping up bits of their houses to burn in the winter in order to keep warm their furniture and so on. No proper transport. And again, the return to the village is everybody's defence against starvation, and it's used on a very wide scale. In the winter of 1920 to 1920, and the Bolsheviks went through 1920 convinced that the way out of this situation was to continue with the forced march approach that they'd used during the Civil War. If we could beat the whites and the greens and the social revolutionaries by sheer will and sheer mobilization militarily, then surely we can solve a problem, they thought, of economic reconstruction in a similar way. And that's what they tried to do. That policy culminated in a disaster in the winter of 1920 to 1921, where the transport system of the country froze up. The trade froze up. The peasants couldn't get their heads around the idea of giving up their foodstuffs for townspeople for nothing, which is what requisitioning is. And the whole crisis culminated in a shortage of food in the cities, discontent in the countryside, and in the spring of 1921, a big strike wave and the revolt at Kronstadt by the sailors, who had been really at the forefront of the revolution in 1917 and who demanded democracy in place of the single party rule that the Bolsheviks had implemented during the Civil War. So a huge crisis in 1921, and as a result of that, the adoption of the new economic policy by the Bolshevik Party, which replaced the idea of food requisitioning with a tax in kind on the peasantry, which a system which gave them some kind of money incentive to produce more food and things to exchange for that money, should they get that money. So a big effort to get those factories going, which would provide goods for the countryside. And in 1921 to 1922, an economic recovery then gets underway. And one of the things I found quite remarkable was that that actually happens quite quickly. The initial improvements are quite rapid. There are factories which have been, you know, this is a country which has become quite industrialized in the run-up to the First World War, and it's a question of not starting from nothing but switching back on industrial capacity that's been shut down in the, through the war and the Civil War. The factories are organized into industrial trusts, very important and powerful bodies in the 1920s. And really for the rest of the period I covered into the mid-20s, but onwards up until at least 1926, there's a gradual improvement of living standards for workers in Russia. And I'll come on to talk about my conclusions from that, which is that there's something which I called in the book a social contract, where basically the Bolshevik Party is saying to the workers, we'll deal with politics, keep out of that or you'll be in trouble, but what you can do is work with us to improve productivity and improve production. And to the extent that that increases, your living standard, we guarantee, will continue to increase. And actually, they kept that side of the bargain, and the living standard got back to where it had been in 1913 by the mid-1920s and continued to improve until the next great economic turn, which is the first five-year plan, the forced industrialization and collectivization of the late 1920s, which we're not going to talk about today, or I'm not going to talk about today, because that's really the another chapter. So that's really, in extremely brief form, those things that were happening in Moscow in that period, and I'm going to just take you through now what I learned from the research in the archives about how that was experienced, first by rank-and-file communists, second by workers, and then I'll talk about the way that social relationships were changing. So the Communist Party was not a monolithic organization. It did not behave in a monolithic way in this period. It was itself changing rapidly in terms of membership composition and organizational structure. And probably the most important thing to bear in mind, that the largest group of Communist Party members, more than 80%, had joined after the October Revolution. Most of the rest of that 20% had joined in 1917, between February, when the parties were legalized, and October, and a tiny, tiny proportion were those people whose books and articles we've all read in translation, the leaders of the Bolshevik Party. But the vast majority of Bolsheviks were people who joined after the revolution, during the Civil War, and many of them had joined in the course of the Civil War at the front, where they were serving as Red Army soldiers. So these people in 19 to 20, not all, but many, many of them were demobilized. They left the front and returned to Moscow, and a characteristic of the opposition groups that sprung up in the Communist Party in 1920, and jointly the oppositions came very close to winning a majority on the Moscow Committee of the Party in 1920. And that's not a kind of nerdy sort of historical detail. And Moscow was the capital of the country. And for the oppositions to come so close, I mean, within a few votes at a conference in November 1920, to winning the majority was an enormous crisis for the Bolshevik Party. And there are clear reasons why some of these, what I call Civil War communists, the people who joined the party at the front, fed into these oppositions. They returned to the capital, where the process of this consolidation of a new state had been going on already for 3 years. The embryonic state bureaucracy had acquired material privileges. I'm sure they all lived worse than I now do in southeast London, but what matters is the comparison. Compared to most workers in Moscow, people working in government offices and in the offices of these new industrial trusts lived a lot better. This was shocking to people who'd been at the front, because particularly those young idealists who joined the Communist Party, and I'm not using the word idealist in a negative sense, they had a sense of a brotherhood of arms, where they'd been fighting under harsh conditions and shared absolutely everything, even when there wasn't very much. And it was a brotherhood. There weren't very many women included in this. And these young men come back from the front, and they're confronted with the fact that this new world that they thought they were building, and this new state they thought they were building, is already, as far as they're concerned, very unequal. And in the middle of 1920, there's an enormous internal conflict in the Bolshevik Party about the so-called tops and the ranks. And it means the conflict between those who have more stuff and those who have less stuff. And a demand that there's equality between communists, which goes through the ranks like wildfire. In 1921, when the new economic policy is introduced, many of these young Civil War communists see that as a travesty and a betrayal. Again, they think that this thing that they had in their minds when they were fighting the whites, which they called socialism, and you know, perhaps in the discussion period, you know, we might think about, you know, what did they mean by that word socialism? Because they thought it was something that would be created collectively, created with a state that would nationalize, as it did during the Civil War, everything, but that somehow then everything would be shared out equally and everybody would work collectively towards the greater good. And one of the very interesting things for any of the historians amongst you who know the history of the workers' movement is an American right-wing socialist called Edward Bellamy, who wrote a novel called, I've forgotten what the title is in English, because Looking Backwards, which is this kind of horrible vision of these sort of labor armies of the future that will, in a disciplined way, with guardians, or I can't remember the term he uses, but there's a group of special people who give all the instructions. And Lenin's wife, Krupskaya, who's an educationalist, and she wrote to one of her comrades and said, "I'm absolutely aghast that all our young comrades are reading this Edward Bellamy and they think it's great." So what the idea of socialism is something we should ask about. But in any case, when it gets to 1921 and the Bolshevik Party says, okay, we're no longer going to try and do everything on a collective and nationalised basis, and we're going to step backwards and we're going to make a compromise with the peasantry, who we have defined as being petty bourgeois, and we're going to trade with them and we're going to get the economy going using these market mechanisms, a lot of these young communists were horrified and in some extreme cases committed suicide. And in many other cases, streamed out of the Bolshevik Party, so that the largest group which left the Bolshevik Party and formed an opposition outside, which was led by this guy, Vasily Panyushkin, who'd started off as a kind of, I think we could call him a hard man of the revolution, and who had been implicated in the killing of a whole number of naval cadets in 1917 in Petrograd, and had gone out and carried out various kind of repressive operations on some of the fronts and so on. So, I mean, he was, you know, he was one of the hard men. And he then left and took a lot of people with him. And that was in early 1921. He formed a Workers' and Peasant Socialist Party, which was rapidly repressed with a number of arrests in May 1921. Another group, which I think is very interesting, was a group called Workers' Truth. This was a group alone amongst these opposition groups that was led by women, two whose names and sort of biographies we know from the archives, women who served in the Red Army, who came back from the front and who were being educated at the communist unit, one of the communist universities, which was set up for a lot of these young communists, many of whom were perhaps barely literate, many of whom had never had a formal education beyond the age of perhaps 12 or 13. And one of the things the Bolsheviks were very keen to do was to educate these people, to participate in administration and so on, and put them in these universities. Some did not get the message about their future as administrators and continued to see themselves as communists and as people who were building a better future. And some of those people ended up in this Workers' Truth group, who published, I think, a very thoughtful manifesto in 1921. And again, alone, I think, amongst these groups, put what to my mind was quite a sort of... They said, look, this is a regime of the technical organizing intelligentsia, and the Bolshevik Party, we can't really talk about it representing the working class. We need to admit that it's become a representative of this new technical organizing intelligentsia, of which, of course, by being in this university, they were being trained to take part. And they said that this intelligentsia will merge with elements of the old bourgeoisie and form a new bourgeoisie. I think it's quite, you know, for people who are participating, it's a very acute analysis for what's going on around them. And what's quite depressing is that each one of these groups is consistently kind of You know, they start posting their stuff to factory committees in the post, and then the Cheka, the secret police, use a lot of effort to try and track these people down. They're all arrested in September of 1923, when there's another kind of strike wave. So there's no sense that there's going to be a discussion about these issues. The other thing that happens to communists is that they go into administration. And the secretary of the Moscow Communist Party writes in despair at this time about how the Communist Party is just like a pump. It's functioning as a pump to suck activists out of the factories and put them into administration. And so if you really, the communists at this time, if they don't go into one of these opposition groups, they're sucked by this pump, they're put into these administrative jobs. And that really is the basis in many ways for, that's one of the bases for the new elite. I'm looking at my watch, so let's talk about the way that these years were experienced by non-party workers. And clearly the focus in something which, again, I'm sure many of you are aware of, was something I mentioned, which was this revolt in spring of 1921. Workers had suffered incredible hardship. In Moscow, in the middle of 1920, there was the largest strike in 1920 was on the trams, and it was one of the main demands was equality of rations. So you had people, you know, taking the mickey in the leadership of these trusts and in the Communist Party. You know, they'd get two rations or three rations or special rations, and no matter how often the party committees did, as they did, take decisions that no special rations, everybody gets the same, and so on. And I mean, there are very inspiring examples of like Nikolai Bukharin going to the Central Committee and saying, sorry guys, I'm not going to live in a hotel with you guys, I'm going to live in a flat just like any other worker. And he's actually instructed, this was a real eye-opener for me, sort of instructed by Lenin, no, you have to live in the hotel, which, you know, it implies much better conditions with the rest of the leadership. I think a very sort of telling little exchange. But anyway, so all this about rations, and this feeds into the big movement in 1921, but it's not just an economic movement. There's been vast exaggeration about the influence either of anarchists or Mensheviks or other political groups on this movement, and I think it's exaggerated, but it is a political movement, particularly in Petrograd and Kronstadt, in fact, more so in Petrograd and Kronstadt than in Moscow. And in Petrograd, in the big factories, they're having meetings, they're gathering big series of political demands, and at the top of the list is always the lifting on the ban of the ban on pro-Soviet but anti-Bolshevik parties. And that did mean the Mensheviks, left SRs, anarchists, syndicalists. There was a demand for the ban on all such groups to be lifted, for freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, for an end to any privileges for the Communist Party. So although these things are in the well-known manifestos of the Kronstadt sailors, they're also in many, many, many factory resolutions, particularly in Petrograd of that time. Big protest movement coalesced, but it was not united, and it was not coordinated. And the strike wave in Moscow, the strike wave in Petrograd, the strike wave in some provincial cities like Saratov, and the Kronstadt revolt, they're all out of time chronologically. So I think kind of post-facto attempts to say this was a third revolution and so on, that for me don't work because there's no coordination. But there's an enormous movement against the... Not only just... I mean, there's a certain... This is all fed by a lot of economic discontent, which you could argue was a fault of Bolshevik tactics and of the situation everybody was in, and not a fault of Bolshevism as such. But there's also a big call for Soviet democracy and for a renewal of the sort of Soviet democracy that was very widespread in 1917. And that's very clearly an anti-Bolshevik demand. In Moscow, and that's where I focused on my research, what's very interesting about this movement for wider Soviet democracy is that it's led by people who are specifically identifying themselves as non-party socialists. To use the Russian word bezpartinyi to describe themselves. And they were not, again, this is just saying this because post facto it's been written up this way by some historians, they were not by and large closet Mensheviks and social revolutionaries. In fact, they disliked the Mensheviks and social revolutionaries who tried to join their ranks because they said, well, you guys are just deserting your organizations when those organizations are having a hard time, and that's not a good basis for doing anything. These people were, there were some who had been already in 1917 decrying any splits politically within the workers' movement and had a very strong workerist and syndicalist strain of different kinds. And in April 1921, so there's the revolt that Kronstadt is put down with violence by the government, the wave of protests recedes, and at that point there's an election, first in some years, for the, because there's not one, been one really since the beginning of this, of the Civil War, for the Moscow Soviet. And in the big factories, in the industrial workers, the majority vote for these so-called non-party candidates. And some of them is literally like, oh, Fred, you stand. You know, we've got to have somebody on the non-party ticket against the Bolsheviks. But in other cases, it's the result of a much greater level of organization. So it depends. But in any case, they had the majority in the big factories, not in the Soviet as a whole, because, as I said to you before, half the working population were bureaucrats, white-collar workers, government officials of different kinds. So the Bolsheviks had a kind of clear majority based mainly on those people. But the Bolsheviks themselves in Moscow regarded this as a disaster, that the class they were supposed to represent, the working class, deserted them. So we've come out of the Civil War, we're building the new society, we've made it through the Kronstadt episode, we're moving on to the next stage, and the working class at that point is not with the Bolsheviks politically, and they regarded that as a disaster. That did not lead them to cooperate with these people. They spent a fair bit of energy trying to break them up and to get at the Moscow, the factory committees that they represented. So from that point, from 1921, there's I mentioned the evolution of this sort of social contract. We'll do the politics, said the Bolsheviks, you guys increase productivity and production. And I mean, I won't speak at great length about this, just keeping an eye on the time. We can come back to it. This meant there were certain forms of political so-called activity which were acceptable. So if there was a campaign against the church, as there was in 1922 on the grounds that the church valuables should be sold to for famine relief, a campaign against the leaders of the Social Revolutionary Party were put on a big political trial in the middle of 1922. You could march in support of such campaigns all you wanted. That's fine. But organize a meeting, discuss anything. You could organize a meeting to discuss what's going on in the factory, and if you've got a corrupt manager who's actually going to not do anything for production, you can have a meeting to discuss what to do about him. But if you want to discuss broader political issues, you're going to hit problems. And if you lead a strike, you're going to be subject to the same sort of labour discipline as in capitalist countries at that time, which is you get sacked. And this was also an exclusive policy. If you were not an industrial worker in a factory, you were not regarded as a worker. If you were a woman at home, you were specifically not regarded as a worker. And in fact, women in the Bolshevik Party started a campaign to try to organize women who are outside the workplace, and that was specifically rejected by some of the senior women leaders. Clara Zetkin, who was a German communist, was in Russia at this point, played a particularly poor role in that discussion. Right, so that's non-party workers. So finally, how social relations evolved. Again, you know, we could talk for hours about this, but to try to keep it brief, I'll just look at four aspects: political authoritarianism, material inequality, emergence of the new elite, and workplace relationships. I mean, I think I've spoken about the political authoritarianism that developed really during the Civil War, and it doesn't change. And you see a gradual process of the Communist Party monopolizing politics throughout this period. And not only is these dissident groups from the Bolshevik Party in 1920-21, but all the other pro-Soviet anti-Bolshevik groups, the left SRs, anarchists and so on, are squeezed out and effectively made illegal by about 1922. Material inequality, there are statistics. There was a big fight during the Civil War about specialists, so the best paid people in industry who had technical training being allowed to get 8 times more than the minimum wage. And it was a big fight, a big controversy. In 1924, the union that represents a lot of these white-collar workers did a survey of its membership and found that 15,000 of them were earning between 15 and 30 times more than the minimum wage. And 1,500 of them admitted to the people who were doing the survey, I mean, to say nothing about illegal earnings, which of which there were lots, 1,500 of them admitted to earning more than 30 times the minimum wage. The Bolshevik tradition was that whatever the inequality with specialists in industry and so on, there should be equality amongst members. I mentioned that before with respect to the Civil War. In 1922, this tradition is formally ended with a Congress decision that specified 15,000 party officials who should receive management-type salaries and all sorts of other valuable benefits like guaranteed housing, medical support, childcare, education, which in Russia in 1922 is a huge deal. And, I mean, basically, emergence of the new elite, what I want to say about that is that it's very difficult to identify a new elite with large numbers at any time up to the mid-1920s. It's in a very embryonic form. But what's really amazing is that although it is so small, all the sort of habits of hierarchy and authoritarianism that we all know about in capitalism are re-emerging in society in all kinds of ways. And what I want to say about workplace relationships really is that this is alienated labour, of course, that these workers are performing in factories. Coming from the background in a Trotskyist organisation, I mean, that's something that was never really... that's something that is not by many socialist groups, that's not really put at the centre of any analysis about what sort of state this was. And I think we have to, it's as meaningless to call the Soviet state that state capitalist as it is to call it socialist. But I think you can't analyse it without acknowledging the fact that there's this alienated labour which is really at the centre of it, and all these hierarchical and authoritarian relationships have been effectively reproduced by this time. So, conclusions. It's very simple and not very helpful to say that if the Bolsheviks had done this or that differently, things might have been different. But I think the time that I was writing about, they clearly did have some room for manoeuvre. And I think the whole issue of Soviet democracy, which is, this is not me sitting in South London 80 years later talking about it. I mean, this was a big slogan, a big demand, and a big fight by workers at the time. They didn't think that was something they could do. And to my mind, what is really damaging is that this process was labelled in order to give the government some sort of legitimacy building socialism. And in a way, the identification of socialism with productivism, with state building, without competing capitalism on the fields of technology, military production, or whatever, that was so widespread throughout the 20th century, I think a lot of it stems from here. And the idea that it involves a much more profound transformation of the relationships between people was largely lost sight of. So, I mean, those were some of the conclusions I drew from the research, but hopefully if we're going to have questions now, people will put other ideas. So,